All right, what we do on this evening, so tomorrow, as Dr. Truman pointed out, as Carl pointed out, tomorrow he's going to do two talks, and then tomorrow we will also have a Q&A time where you can ask questions of him and grill him with all your burning questions. We'll do that tomorrow afternoon where there'll be an opportunity for that. Tonight it's more just an opportunity to get to know him a little more as you listen to him for the rest of the weekend. And so just going to do a little bit of a Q&A time here, and then we'll close this evening before we come back together tomorrow. But Carl, first talk, very helpful. We were talking about how you set the stage, but set the stage for us about you. You're married, you have kids, your wife's with you. Tell us a little bit about your family.
Yeah, I've been married for 33 years. My wife is down there somewhere. Made sure I got the number right.
Another coat. You just had to buy another coat is all you would have to do.
I noticed as we were walking through Detroit Airport today. By the way, this is my way as an Englishman of not talking about myself and answering the question. As we were walking through Detroit Airport, a shop with a coat label that my wife is a bit of a fan of is there in the airport. So Sunday afternoon could be a long afternoon waiting for the plane.
We'll pass the hat tomorrow is what we'll do.
We have two grown children. One of them is married, lives just outside Philadelphia. And has a daughter, so we became grandparents 18 months ago.
Congratulations.
Which is great. And he and his wife, I think, are just about to join the EPC church in the town where they live, where the pastor's a very good guy. And my youngest son he went to Georgetown for university and stayed in the D.C. area. He's an economist / data analyst for Capital One, and is a member of McLean Presbyterian Church, just outside D.C.
Pastor.
And was almost made a deacon there last year, until it was discovered that he'd only been a member for 11 months and fell foul.
Right.
Of it. So he was introduced to Presbyterianism and its Book of Church Order, etc., etc. So, but both of our boys, we're very pleased that they continue to walk with the Lord. And
so the Trumans are EPC, OPC, and PCA.
Yeah, and I can tell you why I'm not PCA.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I am not PCA because when we moved to Philadelphia, the kids were very small, and we attended for a while a PCA church and an OPC church, trying to work out where to go. And because we couldn't really divide them on the basis of the one being better than the other in any way, we had a family vote, and I lost.
Really?
3-1.
That shocks me.
The Lord was gracious. I was saved from a foolish, foolish opinion.
Oh, Carl, you're paying me. So your whole ordination track could have been different if you'd won that vote.
Yeah, I could have contracted PCA and been
tested
positive for PCA.
You'd have just been a little bit more sanctified.
No, I'm in the OPC, but when I passed it in the OPC, we were always known as the Renegade OPC in Philadelphia.
Yes.
I'm told.
Yeah.
Mainly because we used an overhead projector.
Yeah.
For worship, but we used the overhead projector to put psalms up on the screen because there weren't enough psalms in the hymn book.
Right, that seems to balance out.
That makes you a renegade in the OPC.
Yes.
You use modern technology to be more reactionary.
Love it, love it. All right, so tell us a little bit about your upbringing because you love to talk about yourself.
I grew up.
Yes, so I know we're dealing with used that word earlier to translate privacy. So we're dealing with that. But tell us a little bit about your upbringing, how you came to saving faith.
Yeah, grew up in a loving home, not a Christian home. Mum and dad both left school at 16 because they came from fairly humble backgrounds and couldn't afford to stay at school and go on to college. But my dad loved books and taught me to love books. And from the get-go, one thing I knew that was going to happen to me was I was going to go to college because my dad was going to send me to I had got to go to college. And we happened to live in an area of the country which was still had what they call a grammar school. Grammar schools are what Americans would call public schools. That means something different in England. Public school means very private school, but it was a state-run school, but you had to pass a test to go. And it was really a way of allowing kids from humble backgrounds, relatively humble backgrounds, to have a sort of elite education. So I passed the entrance test and went to the local grammar school. I'm listed in Wikipedia as one of their distinguished alumni, I believe.
Really?
They obviously haven't followed my career very closely, but that's a bit like being, you know, one of the most tallest buildings in Topeka, Kansas. It's that sort of sort of thing. And I was fortunate enough there to be taken under the wing of the classics master. I not only learned Latin as part of my regular curriculum, but he taught me Greek during the lunch hours. So I went on and I got a place at Cambridge to do classics. And I studied classics at Cambridge. And really, as a result of having heard Billy Graham preach when I was about 17, and then being given good Christian books, I think I became a Christian during my first year at Cambridge. Really, I remember the night it all became clear, and it was not a lightning bolt conversion. It was just the night that finally everything made sense. I was reading an old battered copy of a book that had been given to me by a local Baptist pastor, J.I. Packer's God's Words. And it was that book that did it for me. Many, many years later, I had the honor, I only met him once, but I had the honor of being flown by Westminster Seminary to Vancouver to give Dr. Packer an honorary doctorate because he was too ill to travel by that point, too old to travel. And the funny thing was, we grew up, he's much older than me, 40 years older than me, but we grew up within 12 miles of each other in Gloucestershire. Really? Both went to grammar school, so it was this immediate bond. The Gloucestershire Grammar School boy. And he did get angry with me at one point. We spent a day together. There was one moment, it was a flash of anger because I'd written an essay in his Festschrift. And he said to me, "You wrote an essay in my Festschrift, didn't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "And you were the one person who criticized me." said, and then in a very English J.I. Packer way, he said, "Remind me again, what did I do wrong?" And I said to him, "Well, Dr. Packer," I said, "as far as I'm concerned, you are the great Presbyterian leader we never had." And he banged the table and he pointed his finger at me and he said, "I am an Anglican by conviction." And there was this flash of fire.
Yeah.
And then he all went calm down again. But J.I. Packer, huge influence on me. And he signed, I took that book out and he signed it for me. It's on eBay now if anybody wants to buy it. it sits on a shelf in my office. The book that brought me to faith, signed by the man who wrote it. It's a very valuable treasure.
What was it about Packer that stirred you, reading him?
Packer gave... I think it's true to say that temperament has a lot to do with how one comes to faith. I saw this in my two sons. I think for my one son, conversion involved much more an appeal to the emotions. To the other son, much more an appeal to the intellect. And I think what Packer did for me was... It was, a lot of my Christian friends were charismatics, and I'm very grateful for their witness. And you'd be hard-pressed to find anything I've ever written where I criticize charismatics, because I really do think that it's important to be grateful to the people who've been kind and helpful and generous to you. But what my friends who were charismatics didn't give me was any intellectual substance. And that, I think, was what was really stopping me from connecting all the dots. And what Dr. Packer gave me was intellectual substance. That made the difference. And also, he kept referring to John Owen. He has this habit of saying, "Well, if you want to know more about this, read John Owen." So in those days, you couldn't go on the computer and order a book. I went to the local library, and they used to have these massive books, books in print, they were called, that allowed you to find out which books were still in print. And I looked up John Owen. He was still in print. And I wrote down the address of the publisher, got in touch with the publisher, Banner of Truth. And I bought a volume of John Owen, and that was a an important moment as well.
Yeah. So is that what led you down the path of PhD studies then?
Yeah, that not being able to get a job doing anything else. I applied for quite a few other jobs and drew complete blanks. But then I remember a friend saying to me, if you could do anything in the world, what would you want to do? And I said, I would love to do a PhD learning more about the Reformation. And he said, well, why don't you put in an application and see? And I said, well, even if I got a place, I couldn't get the money. It happened, I got a place, and Aberdeen University also gave me a full scholarship. So I had 3 years fully funded. Yep. And that's where I met my wife. We met at the Bon Accord Free Church of Scotland, which was a Presbyterian Congregation of Presbyterian Denomination. Yep.
Ivor was there.
Ivor Martin, good friend. And he was not the minister at the time, but when I returned to Aberdeen to teach on faculty in the late 90s, Ivor Martin, who I'll be seeing next week in Atlanta, he's going to be at a conference in Atlanta. Yeah. Ivor was the pastor, and I was ordained as a ruling elder and served on session with Ivor for a couple of years. Ivor, good friend, and still one of the most affecting preachers that I know.
Yeah. He's a mutual friend if you get an opportunity. Ivor Martin, look up his sermons and preaching, just a gifted.
And his wife is from the same Hebridean island as my own wife.
Yeah.
Lewis connection.
So why Reformation? Why was that the pull, Carl? What?
I've always been interested in controversial individuals. This morning I was teaching on Karl Marx in the humanities class. Marx fascinates me. Controversial, explosive thinker. And in my final year at Cambridge, I came across Roland Bainton's book, Here I Stand, on Martin Luther. Still one of the books, anybody says to me, what should I read on Martin Luther? Read Roland Bainton. It's a great biography. The interesting thing about Bainton is Bainton was, I think he was a Unitarian and a conscientious objector in the Second World War. Bainton was an outsider. And that oddly means that he has a real gift to write about outsiders. He doesn't agree with Luther theologically, but he knows what it's like to be a guy under heat. He knows what it's like to be the only guy in the room holding the opinion he holds. So Bainton writes with peculiar sensitivity about Luther, and the story just blew me away. I mean, it's got everything. You've got one man against the world, you've got Frederick the Wise's special forces kidnapping him after the Diet of Worms. You've got him quietly advising somebody on the side that, okay, why don't you just marry two wives and that'll solve the problem, and that lands him in hot water. It's got everything. He just struck me as a crazy character, and I wanted to learn more about him.
Yeah.
That was what, it was Luther that switched me onto the Reformation. And it's still, the joke when I taught at Westminster was that I should recall, the student said, you should rename the course you call the Reformation. You should actually call it Luther and a couple of other guys. That sort of captures what you do much more accurately.
Uh-huh. I bet most people in this room have not read Martin Luther. If they were going to read Martin Luther, what would you recommend they start with?
Don't start with the 95 Theses. The odd thing about the 95 Theses that, so say, trigger the Reformation is that unless you have a pretty decent grounding in late medieval theology, you won't understand what he's talking about. Start with the freedom of the Christian man. Sometimes it's translated the liberty of the Christian. Yeah. Crossway have just produced a wonderful new translation by a good friend of mine, Robert Kolb, who's a senior Luther scholar, that I did the foreword for. It's a little booklet. You can read it in an hour. It was written in 1520, and 1520 is, I consider that to be Luther's most glorious year for theological production. So I would say start with the freedom of the Christian man, and if you like that, read some of the sermons. Don't read them for the exegesis. He's not a great exegete, but read them for the way he talks about Christ. And if you want something heavier, The Bondage of the Will.
Yes.
Translated, you can get a translation by J.I. Packer.
Yeah.
And J.I. Packer translated that as a very young man. And that book was instrumental in turning a lot of British evangelicalism away from a kind of Wesleyan Arminianism towards a higher understanding of the sovereignty of God. It's a flawed book. There are arguments that Luther makes there that I don't think I would want to make and I don't think necessarily hold water. But it is a very significant book, both for understanding Luther and for understanding later Christianity as well. Yeah.
Good. All right, switch topics here a little bit. You're at Grove City.
Yep.
And teaching students there. You've taught at Westminster. You've taught at Aberdeen. What are some of the changes that you've seen in students over the years, and especially at Grove City? Are you encouraged? Are you discouraged?
I'm very encouraged at Grove City. It has to be said, Grove City is not a cross-section of the American student population. We draw most of our students either from Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, Northern Maryland, or West Virginia. So a lot of them come from what I would call traditional working or lower middle class homes, where they've been taught that hard work and a good education is the way to get on. So very good work ethic among students at Grove. And also we have a strong Christian component. So we draw widely from students wanting a serious Christian education. So I'm very encouraged by what's going on at Grove. What have I noticed over the years? The big difference between seminary education and undergraduate education, of course, is that at seminary, I think seminary professors are, by and large, giving students better arguments and reasons for what they believe already. With undergraduates between 18 and 22, the students are sort of adults, but not quite adults, and it's a real battle for the minds. But the minds are open. So I love the classroom at Grove because it's a kind of, can sometimes be a sort of friendly combat, because the students really want to learn and they really want good arguments. So I love teaching undergraduates. What have we seen over the years? I think the most noticeable thing has not necessarily been my classroom experience, which continues to be just a delight to me. Privilege has become a word that you're supposed to feel guilty about these days. I only ever use privilege about things I feel grateful about. It's a great privilege to teach, and I'm very grateful that I've been able to spend my life doing that. I think the thing that I've noticed most and that saddens me most is the level of anxiety among young people. Every year at the opening faculty meeting at Grove, one of the things we get a report on is, you know, how many kids use the counseling service at Grove in the last year, either for themselves or for a friend. And I think it runs at between 40 and 45%.
Wow.
That's pretty staggering. Now, on one level, that could be a good thing, because it could mean there's less stigma involved now in seeking help. And so it's good that those who perhaps in the past suffered in silence are now seeking help. But I don't think that it can be entirely accounted for by that. You know, when I was at college, I guess there probably was a counseling center somewhere. Nobody ever told me about it. I don't think that I necessarily knew such a thing existed, even conceptually. And I certainly didn't have professors, you know, at Grove, we have to, on every syllabus, put the phone number of the counseling center. And rightly so, I think it's a good thing. Not criticizing that, but it strikes me as sad that we have to do that now.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that comes down to some of the stuff I was talking about in the earlier lecture. In some ways, you know, the LGBTQ stuff is the stuff we worry about most as Christians relative to what's going on in society. But I wonder if perhaps the thing that should worry us most of all is not that specific thing, but just the general collapse in the sense of what it means to be a self, a human being, to have an identity. I fear that these statistics, and Grove at 40-45%, I think that's pretty typical across the nation. It's not that Christian colleges are 40% and other colleges are 20 or 80. You go to any college and I think you'll find that kind of broad range being the typical take-up rate of stuff. And that's the discouraging thing. Kids are always great. I love working with kids, but it saddens me that their lives at their age are not as happy as my life at their age was.
Yeah. So you have a lot of, there are a lot of parents here, a lot of grandparents. We all care about kids as they're part of our congregations, etc. as you're thinking about that and thinking about the battle of the mind as they come to you, what are some things you wish, oh, these would be helpful things if parents were talking through these things with their kids or sensitive to these?
Yeah. In some ways, I'm going to touch on that a little bit in the third lecture tomorrow, but I think one of the things that, and I've used this as a sort of rule of thumb as I've gone through life on other things, you know, if this person isn't talking to me, who are they talking to? And I think, you know, as parents, you need to be the kind of people that your kids can talk to about some of this pressing stuff. Because if they don't feel able to talk to you, they'll talk to somebody else. They may well talk to some of the most evil people on the face of the planet, particularly if they have a smartphone, because they can get easy access to the most evil people on the face of the planet via a smartphone. So I would say as parents, and again, I feel very privileged and blessed on this that my wife and I, we never had a communication breakdown with our kids, that we weren't able to talk to them and they weren't able to talk to us. I think parents need to try to keep that open. I also, you know, kids, amazing to tell, don't need smartphones. I think if you give a kid a smartphone, well, you know, would you hand over a hardcore porn video to your kids? No, you wouldn't. But you gave them a cell phone. You just did. You just did. And your children are better at technology than you are. So I would say no kid needs a smartphone. Now, again, I'm saying that as a parent for whom that was not an issue. It's going to be an issue for my son and daughter-in-law. I'm going to be saying to them, it's up to you, but don't give her a smartphone. Yeah. So I would say smartphones. No, the kids will hate you for you, but you're meant to be a parent, not a friend.
Amen.
Kids are going to hate you for making them eat their greens at points, but you've got to do it. So it's easy and glib to say that, but I really do think that smartphones are the most lethal thing you can put in the hands of a kid.
Agreed.
And I would encourage, one of my side sort of gigs is I'm a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is a kind of Judeo-Christian think tank in Washington. Look up the work that my colleague Claire Morrell is doing. She's a young mom. She attends, her husband is one of the pastors at Mark Dever's church in D.C. She is of a caliber that I think if we ever got a Republican president, she'd be tapped for a State Department position. Very, very sharp, top Georgetown grad, working at the moment on technology, trying to get material produced that helps parents negotiate, navigate this with their kids. She's facing the same issues herself. She was, to tell you how great she is, she received a sympathetic profile yesterday in the New York Times, because she is working with state legislatures in cross-party contexts to get legislation about technology, pornography, etc., on the statute books. So I would say to parents, you know, get yourself up to speed on the evils that pornography can do and find out what you can do to mitigate its influence on your kids. And Claire Morrell's stuff, go to eppc.org, look up Claire Morrell, see the sort of stuff she's writing and producing. And I think you'll find materials there to really help you think through the issues.
Good. So along those lines, if you were to recommend, give us a couple of books, two or three books that you'd say, oh, if you're a thinking Christian, these would be helpful things to read as you're wrestling through some of these cultural issues today, some of the things that are facing this generation.
Yeah, that's a tough one. In terms of things addressing the culture, I think that James K.A. Smith's book, How Not to Be Secular, which is his summary of Charles Taylor's massive book. You know, if you can read A Secular Age, great. I teach it at Grove. I do a undergrad seminar where we read it together. But it's about 900 badly written pages. If you want the heart of the argument, James K.A. Smith's How Not to Be Secular.
Because Charles Taylor... You referenced him before, but give a brief bio on the importance of Charles Taylor.
Charles Taylor is a Canadian philosopher. He's kind of Catholic of a fairly liberal variety, I think, but has... Taylor's great... The way I found Taylor helpful was Taylor was the man who alerted me to two things. One, that the issues we face today in society track back to the big question of what is man? The issues we face are anthropological questions. And the second thing that they got from Taylor in broad terms was, it's not a matter of arguments, it's a matter of the imagination. He has this rather awkward term, the social imaginary. But the way he's using it, is what he's trying to get at is this: the way most of us think about the world is not in terms of propositions and arguments and deductive reasoning. It's more intuitive than that. Why don't we steal? Well, you might say, I don't steal because it's against the law. Well, most of us don't steal, actually, not because it's against the law. We don't steal because our mum told us it was bad to steal. And every time we're tempted, we hear mum's voice whispering in our ear, for example. Or we live in communities where stealing is regarded as shameful. Most of us, in fact, all of us, connect to the world in a very deep way in terms of our intuitions. I'd use gay marriage as an example of this. Conservatives never lost the argument on gay marriage. But that didn't matter. We didn't lose the argument, we lost the imagination. It's too early to get a real perspective on what was influential, but I'm betting when the history of gay marriage is written in 50 years' time, Will and Grace will be far more significant than Judith Butler. It's not that people are reading gender theory, queer theory, gay studies. It's that people are watching soap operas and sitcoms where, guess what? Gay people are presented as most of us experience them in real life, as kind people, polite people, friendly neighbors. And that shapes the intuitions. That shapes the intuitions. And when you're in a culture where we have, I think, the good instinct that we want other people to be happy and comfortable, that reshaping of the intuitions has profound significance. And it was really Taylor that alerted me to that. That, in trying to wrestle through this, why is this statement, I'm a man trapped in a woman's body, become so plausible? I can't go to the seminar rooms of Berkeley to find the answer. I have to look at much broader social and cultural patterns and phenomena. So that's where Taylor is important. And Jamie Smith brings that out quite beautifully in that book. Now, I need to qualify a bit because I don't unequivocally endorse everything that Jamie Smith says Yes. Everywhere. Jamie Smith would, for example, I think I'm right in saying he would endorse gay marriage, for example, I think. So it's not an endorsement of Jamie Smith, but it is an endorsement of Jamie Smith's book on Charles Taylor, which I think is a wonderful text, and I use it with my students as the kind of roadmap for getting through the big book.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know, maybe 150
pages.
Yeah,
and it's pretty jargon-free.
Yeah.
The students actually find it, when we read Taylor, I say, read the section in Smith first, because that will tell you what Taylor's talking about. Now you'll be able to understand what Taylor's talking about. It's very, very clear. Smith is a great communicator.
Good. Good recommendation. All right, you ready for some rapid fire?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Sort of Beatles or Stones, that kind of question.
Yeah, here we go.
Stones, but...
Really?
Yeah, oh yes.
Oh, it's disappointing.
Beatles are a boy band. Come on.
Don't like because they had hair.
In 50 years' time, we'll only have the Rolling Stones left. Everybody else will be dead.
All right, so best guitarist ever?
Jimi Hendrix.
Okay. Name a good English food.
Oh, that's a tough one.
Uh-huh.
Indian curry.
No. That's cheating.
But there's more curry sold in England than in India, I think.
Okay, so. All right. Thing you least like about America?
The casual way men dress on airplanes.
On airplanes specifically?
In particular airplanes, but in general, muscle, and here I'm really getting at my partner in crime, Todd Pruitt.
Uh-huh.
Muscle shirts, no.
If you had muscles, would you think differently?
No. I would just wear a bigger suit.
Okay.
Shoes with like tassels on them. No.
I'm with you. Yeah.
Wearing open-toe sandals to get on a plane. No.
Amen.
I don't want to see another guy's feet under any circumstances.
Yes.
Male, you know, casual male dress is... One of my students said to me recently, do you own a t-shirt? And I said, yeah, I own a t-shirt. And she said, I bet you have a tie dyed on the front of it. So,
excellent. All right, you have a free evening to read. Martin Luther, J.I. Packer, or John Owen?
Oh, that's tough. It would depend on my mood, but I think probably Martin Luther.
Would you rather write a book, Carl, preach a new sermon series, or put together lectures for a new class?
Write a book.
Apple or Microsoft?
Whatever my employer gives me.
Yeah.
Happens to be Microsoft at the moment.
Your favorite Christian biography?
Charles Hodge. The biography of Charles Hodge by Andy Hoffaker.
Yeah.
I think it's a truly... If you know Andy, you know that he's just this gracious and beautiful, sweet person. Would have been your professor, probably. Andy Hoffaker. His son was my son's real estate agent, as it happens. But Andy Hoffaker is one of the most delightful people I know. And it comes out on every page. And he makes... You're reading about Hodge, and I think, am I reading about Hodge, or am I reading about Andy Hoffaker as Hodge?
Yeah,
it's just a great book. Really love it. Really love it.
Great book. Favorite non-Christian biography?
Stalin, Court of the Red Tsar by Simon Sebag Montefiore.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fascinated by Stalin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Not going to follow that one up. All right, if you had to spend the rest of your life in a room... And you have to choose one of these. Irish, Welsh, or Scottish people. What do you choose as an Englishman?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Can I not just die? Oh, goodness gracious. Irish, Welsh, or Scottish?
Uh-huh.
But it's got to be Scottish. My wife is a Scot.
Oh, that's easy.
So it's got to be Scottish.
That's easy. That's excellent. All right, Carl. You've been pretty critical of the evangelical church over the years. What is it that most concerns you about the evangelical church?
I think my criticism arises, it would take a long time to sort of expand on this, but I think it's particularly in America, they use the term evangelicalism. And I'm not sure if it's being used descriptively or prescriptively. And I'm not sure that it actually refers... I think, generally speaking, it's assumed to refer to something real and coherent and cogent that one can then either say has to move in certain directions or one can condemn en masse. That's why I don't like the term. And I think, you know, you see this today with a lot of the bashing of white evangelicalism that goes on. Well, my experience of evangelicalism in America has been this... It's the small churches where I've been members where the soccer mom bakes cookies on a Sunday for the church, where that guy gives up his time to go and fetch the old person who can't drive anymore and bring him to church. And my real concern when we start talking about evangelicalism is it becomes this kind of way of spitting on vast numbers of good, humble, ordinary Christian people who are just loving Jesus, loving the gospel, and serving their local churches. So my concern is that when you say criticizing the evangelical church, more often I think my criticisms have been of a kind of evangelical leadership that tends to operate up here, where actually the real stuff is happening down here. My wife and I have been members of church, We're always on the rosters. At the moment, if you say, what's the thing you do for your church? I serve in the nursery once every 2 months. I broke the glass ceiling for men on that, by the way.
Well.
They were keeping men out.
Oh.
And I smashed the glass ceiling.
Thank you on behalf of all mankind. You know,
yes. But I think it's absolutely critical that people humbly serve in their own church. I really do.
Yes.
And I get worried about those who criticize evangelicalism and those who parade as evangelical leaders. My question is, what do you do in your local church? Don't criticize evangelicalism if you're not on the trash roster. So that's where I would sort of go with that. And also, I'm an Englishman, so the political dimension of American evangelicalism, I don't really have a category for that so much. You know, if anything, historically, British evangelicalism tilted politically slightly left of center, not right of center. And I'm a denominational guy as well. So my energies, such as they are, tend to be focused on either my work through Grove or stuff for my local church and denomination.
Yes. You touched on it just now. You've written on it, but politics in the American church.
Yeah.
Concerning to you, encouraging to you, especially as we head into a new year with politics.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to be encouraged generally about politics in America because it's not obvious where it's going. They can't even elect a Speaker of the House at this point in time. So I think it's difficult to be encouraged on that front. I think that I've always held the view that I would never tell anyone how to vote. I think given the Democratic Party's increasing commitment to a whole variety of social issues, it becomes harder and harder for me to imagine that I could ever vote Democrat. I'm not sure I'd ever say that from a pulpit. And I still think that the personal conscience has to play into how you use your vote. But when you're pushing transgenderism, when you're pushing abortion, these things, I think you're really starting to hit things that strike at the heart of what it means to be a human being, the dehumanization. That's not necessarily saying you should vote for the other side. It's just saying that I think there are scales of dehumanization among our political parties that are becoming increasingly obvious. On the right, I really worry. I don't worry, you hear this talk about white nationalism all the time. I don't worry that white nationalism is going to be an existential threat to American democracy. Brent Rodray is always talking about, we're at a Weimar moment in America. Weimar Germany, that was a nation with no strong tradition of democratic institutions. America is very different. I have a lot of confidence in our democratic institutions that we will get through what's happening at the moment. So my fear about white nationalism is, first of all, I do think it's real, but I don't think it's as widespread as it's claimed. Just because you're a member of Mums for Liberty doesn't make you a white nationalist. But there are white nationalists out there. They make a lot of noise on the web. I'm not sure that they're going to have much of an impact in wider society. What I fear about the guys on the hard right is, I don't think they're going to destroy the country, but I think they could tear denominations and congregations apart. Because I think numerically they're more significant in our denominations than they are in the nation. That's what worries me. Even in the last week, I was listening to something where two professing Christians were talking about, we have no enemies to the right. That's insane talk from a Christian.
Yes.
That's exactly the same talk that on the left means that when Hamas led off against Israel, you're celebrating the slaughter of little children. If there's somebody on the right who is a misogynist, who's teaching the world that my wife, my mother, my sisters, my daughter-in-law, my granddaughter are just sexualized pieces of meat. He's an enemy of mine. Yeah. I'm going to say so. So it really worries me that in the polarization of our political situation at the moment, I'm hearing what I would call Nietzschean kind of language emerging in Christian circles. Now I don't think that's going to destroy the country, but I think it could destroy congregations, ministries, denominations.
As a historian, how does understanding church history impact your view of something like this? This current heightened political, heightened cultural kind of feels like pressure that the American church is at least has angst about.
Yeah.
How do you view that as a historian?
I think we need to remember, first of all, that as bad as the situation seems to be, America's still a pretty good country to be. I became a citizen this year. I've lived here for 22 years. Yeah. I do think that America is, if America was a really, really, really bad country, we wouldn't have an immigration crisis. because people don't immigrate into really, really, really bad countries. So I think there's an element of we need to still be grateful for what we have. And we need to put our problems in perspective. That's not to say they're trivial problems, but it is to say there are bigger problems out there that we could be facing. So I think that that's, we should first of all be grateful for the country we live in. Secondly, I think church history teaches us that the church has faced worse and survived.
Amen.
Stalin, court of the Red Tsar. If Stalin is not able to wipe out Christianity, I don't think that, you know, anybody who's likely to get elected in America is going to pull off that stunt. I really don't. So I think church history teaches us that, surprise, surprise, God's promises are true. Now, that doesn't mean that my congregation or my denomination are going to survive. I don't think the OPC is the meaning of history. But it does mean that God's always going to have his people. And I think that means that our task then is to be faithful. Doesn't mean we sit back and take it all. We should certainly use our civil rights and our civil liberties and the ways and means that we have to make the world a better place. We should certainly do that. But we should realize that ultimately the battle is the Lord's on this front. And I'm going to mention this a bit tomorrow. I also think that we need to think long term. One of the hallmarks of what I was describing today, one of the effects of all that stuff I was describing earlier is it makes us think about time as moving faster. We tend to think of time moving fast because things do change fast. Well, historically, people worked in terms of many, many generations. I'll probably use this tomorrow, but I'll use it tonight. Cologne Cathedral. They start building in the 13th century, 1248, I think. And they completed in 1880. They suspend building for a few hundred years because of the Reformation. But nobody in 1248 thought that they would ever worship in Cologne Cathedral. None of them thought that. But they all thought it was worth doing nonetheless. I remember saying to my wife about a year ago, I think I'm going to lose every single one of the significant cultural struggles we're currently engaged in. I'm 56. Maybe I've got 20 more good years left in me, I don't know. But I'm going to lose every struggle. And that was incredibly liberating. Because suddenly I realized, okay, I haven't got to win by next Wednesday. I just have to make sure that what I do in the next 20 years provides a sufficient foundation for somebody else to carry things forward. And then lo and behold, in the last 12 months, I've started to see real possibility that I might win a cultural battle or two. I will talk about this tomorrow, but I think the trans situation is starting to change.
Agreed.
And I actually think I might see the end of the trans craze in my lifetime. I don't think anybody, you know, some of the best stuff to read today for encouragement is not necessarily the Christian stuff, but get hold of some of the stuff that was being written by Czech dissidents in the 1970s, who were very much focused upon being faithful to keeping the idea of freedom alive. What's interesting when you read them is they didn't think they were going to live to see this. The Prague Spring had been crushed in 68. But many of them did live to see it. So I think we should be faithful. We keep hope alive. And who knows? Maybe we will live to see more great changes than we anticipate.
Amen. That is a great note to end on. Great.
Thanks very much.